We'll have to look through the commit history to see what kind of abominations, war crimes were committed in that repo.
Hello, hello everyone. I'm Gears.
And I'm Mox Valix, and welcome to the Data Pack Podcast, Episode 9.
Episode 9, you remembered this time.
I did. Wow, I'm
don't
so good
know.
at this.
I feel like I remembered better this time as well. It might have something to do with the fact that I'm currently staring at the announcement message which said Episode 8 of the Data Pack Podcast in our Discord. Link in the description, by the way.
You know, I think that might help, yeah.
Today we are going to be talking about. I don't really know that we have a title for this episode yet, but we're just sort of going to be generally talking about Minecraft data pack tips and tricks and hacks and bits and bobs and whatever else happens. We're just going to talk about little interesting things which we found, which you can do in data packs, which, we'll share with other people. So, I guess we can start off because, last time, if you watched all the way till the end of the last episode, which, let's be honest, probably no one did, but if you did, then thank you. And we briefly mentioned, well, we were obviously talking about premature optimization, and we mentioned at the end whether execute if entity at A or slash list is more performant for getting the number of players on a server. And well, we did the benchmark just now, and what did we find?
We found that it was the using at A was faster than using list by about 80,000 iterations, I think, of the benchmark. So basically there's the data pack that we use sometimes for our benchmarking, which effectively runs the function recursively over and over and over again, and then spits out the amount of times it ran. And obviously the
What
more
was it? It was like,
it was
yeah,
500
450,000 to 500,000, which is approximately 11%, right? 11% increase,
doing some generous rounding. Yeah, there we
obviously
go.
benchmarks are a total lie and very misleading, and you shouldn't take what we said as any means of performance testing, because benchmarks most of the time are just utter rubbish, basically, because there's so many things which you don't necessarily account for, like all the other stuff which was going on in the world at the time, everything else that was running on the machine which was running the server, and all sorts of different things which you just can't account for. And but generally it seemed to be slightly faster. I don't know.
Yeah, it seemed to be
Anyway.
slightly faster to use if entity at A
If entity at
versus
A.
slash list. However, my theory, it might be that using run makes it slower because it has to start a new command context. Whereas if entity, you're still in that same execute command. I'm not sure. That's
Interesting,
just
maybe.
a theory on my half. You would get better results by actually reading the code. But we didn't do that. So who knows how it works?
Okay, we just did that to have a bonus clip at the end, really. That's all it was. We just want more watch time.
Exactly.
We just want you to come back for the next episode and subscribe,
That's
or
right.
whatever else you do on non-YouTube platforms.
One like equals one benchmark. Sorry.
Yeah, we okay, we've successfully stalled the first few minutes of this episode, so let's continue to stall it. And talk about some interesting hacks that we found with Datapack. So, okay, one thing which I figured out, which is sort of in my mind because I was talking about it with a different person a while ago, is that you in when return run was first introduced, right? I think it was 1.20 they added the slash return command, but at that point you could only return a literal value as opposed to the result of running command, and then in 1.20.2, they added the ability to use return run and return the result of running command. But at that point, what it would do is if you did slash return run function, if that function didn't return a value, the return run wouldn't return anything and it would just keep on executing.
Huh.
Which sounds kind of weird, right? But I used it to my advantage in a library I was making. It was actually a parsing library for, because I was writing a parser for an assembly language, which I never ended up finishing, which I probably should go back and take another look at some point. But if the command failed, because basically what it would do is it would try and parse a certain sequence of things, and then if it failed, it would backtrack and then try and parse a different sequence.
Yeah.
And so what it would do is if a single thing failed, it would return one or something. And if it succeeded, it just wouldn't return anything. And then what I did was I would do return run function, parse this first bit, and then return run function, parse this next bit, and then return run function, parse this other bit. And then if as soon as one of them failed, that would return a value and then return from the function which called it. And then it would allow it the state to sort of backtrack and get back. But if it got all the way to the end and not a single one of it would return, it would sort of update the state saying, okay, we're now at this point. We've successfully parsed this far and now we can continue parsing again. And I was a little disappointed when they changed it to make it always return, because it meant that that piece of code didn't work anymore, which was kind of a shame. But it was a fun little thing I discovered while that was still a thing.
Yeah, I can see that actually being really useful. It is a bit of a pity that they removed that. They should add something like return if or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
return
that's what
if
I was thinking.
Function, and then it's like, if it's a non-zero value, it returns. Otherwise, it keeps going. That would be kind of cool.
That would be cool.
But yeah, unfortunately, they don't seem to have done that. But the return has been such a great addition to the game, honestly.
Yeah.
It's such a quality of life thing, just being able to exit out of a function early. Because so many issues with, like, larger data packs came down to, like, you have to organize it so that you can break early out of a function. And so you would end up, like, having to do a bunch of execute if checks to basically run all the different parts rather than just being able to exit as soon as the condition is met or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's been genuinely a really good change having slash return and then
run. Yeah, I haven't used slash return that much as an actual return a value because you can only do int values. A lot of the time I just want to return a more complex MBT structure. And so I just do a data storage. But the time I use return most is in like a guard clause is what they're called, where you basically say instead of, you know, in another programming language, it would be instead of doing if a certain thing and then having the rest of the function code being in that if block. And I don't like that because if you have several of those, you get like several levels of indentation with just like one block. Just if this, do that. And then if this, do that. If this, do that. And I just don't like that. But then you use a guard clause instead, where you say, if not this, then
return something. Yeah.
And then otherwise you just continue, because obviously return ends the function, and so you can just continue the function after the if statement, and then if the check doesn't succeed, then yeah. And then you don't get loads of levels of indentation, you just have a few if checks at the top, all the returns, and then you can just continue there. And I do that in empty function. Well, you can do that now. You can go execute unless blah blah blah, run return, and negative one is just one which we've settled on by convention. Because
of the way it used to work, I think, because it would still return the amount of commands that the function ran. Like,
yeah.
Why would it do that? What was the case that it would do that?
It was just...
If it didn't have a return, it would the function would return the amount of commands it ran. So...
Right, before return was added, a function would just return the amount of commands that it run. You could see in chat, running function blah 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 in it function blah blah ran 3 commands or something like that.
In the early days of the slash return command, if the function didn't have a return, it would return the amount of commands it ran. Otherwise, it would return what the return value was. So it would, like, it kind of had 2 different states that it would return. And so we picked -1 to be clearly, you can never have -1 commands. So it was like a shorthand for saying it's just a general return kind of thing. And we've kind of stuck with it now. Even though, like, it's changed,
even though now it doesn't return, it doesn't return the number of commands anymore.
Yeah.
Which is kind of annoying, because then you can't see. I used to like to be able to run a function, see how many commands it executed, and, you know, see the... Yeah, because, like, for optimization of command count, I would like to see how many commands a thing ran.
Yeah.
But you can't do that anymore, which is kind of sad. But yeah, it makes it less ambiguous in terms of return. So yeah, we just stick with -1. I just do it by default now. And yeah, return run is nice, because then you can do, basically, if you're doing like an if else, you don't want to do if a certain thing, do this and then return. But if that thing might mutate the state in some way, that can kind of get a bit messy, because then you've got to make sure that the thing you're running doesn't change the thing you're checking and then returning afterwards. But then you can just do execute if condition run return run, and then the function, and then it just returns and runs the function.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I definitely use return much more for control flow purposes than actual value. Returning values, right?
100%, yeah. Because, like, the other two, like, storage types, I guess, scoreboard and data storage, are just much more, you know, it's... You may as well just write to them directly, because you're going to end up having to write it at the end of the function anyway. That return value has to go somewhere if you want to use it, and it will end up in scoreboard or storage. So...
Yeah, and they both have basically their upsides over slash return, right? Obviously, scoreboards, you can do maths on them very easily, you know, manipulate the values, multiply, add, divide, subtract, whatever. And then storages can hold full MBT compounds and arrays and strings and whatever else, which you can't do with scoreboards and direct returns. So... Yeah, it's just generally better to do that usually.
However, Zoglin, we've made it that direct returns are a little bit nicer to use now.
Yeah.
We've added some syntax to work with direct returns. As a return, like as a function type. And so maybe we might end up starting to use it a bit more, maybe, with Zoglin.
Yeah, potentially, yeah. Okay, next trick is...
Well, I've got one. I got the classic one I always bring up. And I may have mentioned this before in the podcast, I can't remember. But using an entity's tags to perform string filtering is my favorite hack, I think, ever in a data pack, is doing that. And... It's not as useful now with macros, because you can use a macro to quickly check to see if a string exists in an array. But before macros, the only way to do it without having to iterate the whole array, which is a valid strategy, but can get slow, obviously, as more and more entries are in the array. So if you've got a lot of entries, it might be worth making a temp entity, storing all of those strings into its tags field, and then trying to insert a new tag with your custom string, whatever string you want. And if the tags don't change, it means that the value is already in there, because Minecraft validates that MBT field and makes sure that it's like each entry is unique. And that's quite useful.
That's cool. I remember when you told me about that.
Okay.
The other one I was going to say, which again is sort of made obsolete now with macros. They're all made obsolete with macros. Why did Mojang have to add macros? All the fun tricks you could do just gone.
Macros are so useful though.
Yeah, I know. Macros are great. So this was for one of my very first data packs, the Lucky Blocks data pack, and I wanted my Lucky Blocks to be able to not only just drop random items, but also do stuff like summon entities and set blocks and basically run arbitrary commands. And I wanted everything to be data driven by loot tables, so I wouldn't have to go and update any MC function code when I was changing what they could drop, basically. So I had a loot table for each lucky block type, and I would just write stuff in there, basically.
Yeah.
So what I came up with is, and I don't think there's a new, it wasn't an original solution or anything, but I hadn't heard of it before, right? I was still quite new to data packs. I hadn't talked a lot with other people, so I was just still figuring out a lot of stuff myself. And so I figured out that if I had a certain item with a certain custom piece of MBT data, and basically whenever that item was summoned, my tick function would detect it, and it would set a command block there and modify the command field of that command block to be the string of that certain item MBT.
Right.
And then I would set it to auto run, right? Always active. And then the next tick I would clean up the command block, basically. And it's because you've got to wait a tick for it to execute.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really an original solution. You can do it easily with macros now. But I was pretty happy with how it turned out, basically. But there's all this other code which, like this logic you got to do, because obviously you got to keep track of where the command block is, because it's got to stay for a tick. So you got to summon a marker at that position and then do it like the next tick, remove it. But then some of my commands set a block at the position of the command block. So then I had to check if it was still a command block there. But yeah, in the end, I could basically just write a command item in my loot table, and it would just automatically summon a command block there and do stuff, which was pretty useful.
Nice.
And I actually made a video about it. It was my second ever video, and I probably took way too long to explain it. It's like the video is like 20 minutes long, I think, and I don't think I need. If I could remake the video now, I could probably cut it down to about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway. That was a fun little thing that I made. But yeah, now you can just do function, you know, you can just write a function which is about 6 characters long. Minimum 5 characters, I think. And yeah, you can just do that in like 2 commands with macros now.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Macros ruin all the fun.
Yeah, I know.
Another one, I don't know if it still works, but another trick I used to like to do, it was more of a neat thing you could do, is you could check to see whether a string contained valid JSON by setting it as the name of an entity and seeing if it worked or not. Because if it was invalid JSON, it wouldn't actually change the name of the entity. Minecraft would just reject it.
I think that still works. It should still work.
Yeah, it probably does.
More strict on what is valid JSON.
Yeah.
Now.
Moxlib's version of it broke, I think. I think we ended up removing it.
Weren't we looking at the code for it the other day and just and that would just, it looked like it was half finished. I feel like we were.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there. We'll have to look through the commit history to see what kind of abominations, war crimes were committed in that repo.
And also, on a similar note, right, I think I wrote a function which did a similar thing that it wasn't just JSON validation. Do you remember? It was like type of sort of data type checking. And I think I started writing that function and then I realized you already had it or something. I don't remember. But yeah, you can also use NBT arrays to validate whether or not something is of a certain data type, because arrays can only hold one NBT type. So if you have an array of integers and you try and append an integer and it fails, that means you don't have an integer.
Yeah.
So you can use that to essentially categorize different values as different NBT types.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite good.
Yeah.
And
on the flip side of that, if you want to store an array of NBT values with different types, the way we did it in Code of Copper is we basically just have everything have a dot value field on it. So everything is a compound. You have an array of compounds with the dot value, and the dot value contains the actual MBT value of it. And then obviously in Code of Copper, it's a bit more complex because we have a type field which determines what data type it is. And there's all sorts of different stuff in Code of Copper which doesn't map one-to-one with NBT, but you can just do that for NBT by itself, just have an array of compounds containing a dot value, basically.
Yeah, and in fact we're planning, we haven't implemented it yet, we're planning to add support for that to Zoglin, feature of multi-typed arrays, basically, and it'll have special syntax to create and work with those arrays, which should be cool, I think. To pimp Zoglin some more, because people have not heard enough, obviously.
No, hopefully it will be to a point sometime soon where we can do a podcast about it. I don't know when we want to do that, if we want to do it as soon as we get a good version working, or if we want to do it once it's a bit more established so we have more things to talk about. I'm not sure, but we'll do a podcast about it at some point.
It may even end up being a two-parter depending on how much we have to talk about.
I'm sure it will. I have lots to talk about on the subject of data type preprocessors.
Yeah, I guess I can talk about another very hacky thing was how string concatenation worked.
Oh, yeah.
Before we had macros.
Macros.
So this, macros.
This whole episode is basically just turning into all the different interesting and complex things you had to do to get stuff done until macros, and now you can just do it trivially with a couple commands.
I feel like it would be a great YouTube video essay of like Minecraft data packing before there was macros, and you could just deep dive into all of the like wacky do things you had to do to work around the fact you didn't have macros.
All right, I'm stealing that idea. Thanks.
You totally should do it. But yeah, the way that string concatenation worked, it was just, oh. So basically, in 23W03A, the greatest snapshot ever made, that is a hill I will die on.
Honestly, me too.
They added the ability, and you've heard this thousands of times if you've listened to this podcast, they added the ability to split a string into an array of characters. And this, for many reasons, was game-changing. for data packing, because we could actually do stuff with strings now, which we couldn't really. Strings were kind of useless before. To be honest, they were not that good.
Yeah, they were just immutable single lumps values of data, which all you could do is get them from something and put them back to some, you know.
Yeah, you could check for a precise string. You could check to see if a match, but you couldn't do any substring. No parsing, nothing. Which is, well, okay. Not entirely. There was a way to split strings pre...
I still don't fully understand how that works. I should look into it at some point.
I think it abused... like the same tags array concept, and also /enchant would get it in a format where then you could like it would order the tags or something. It would order it somehow, and then the tags would allow you to check if it existed in there or not. It's confusing. I still don't understand it fully either. I watched a video on it a while back, but it's slipped my mind entirely how it works. But what I can somehow explain somewhat is how string concatenation worked in 23WO3A. Yeah, so basically, to do that, you needed to get it such that the strings would end up... You needed to be able to get it to a state where you could predict, where basically in a command block, it would have them all in a row. And I can't remember exactly how that
worked. It was basically an entity. You would use an entity name to
And then you could
to get the storage value, right?
Yeah. You could resolve an entity's name into the output of a command block, and then it was predictable the location that the start would be and the end would be, right? And then you could use that to substring,
right?
Like, but also take the middle.
Just remembered back then, now you can specify a negative index on the end, so you can just say, I want to take 5 off the start and 5 off the end. But then you couldn't. You could specify no index, which would mean you don't take anything off the end. Or you could specify an index from the start. And so, because the string was, you know, of a variable length, basically, I remember you had an iterate function, which would, like, recursively take more off the end until it would try and take, like, or it would, like, build up a value until it got to the length or something.
Yeah.
Because obviously you couldn't macro it.
I think how
you
it worked...
You couldn't macro the length, so you would have to, like, recursively remove values until...
I think how it worked is it actually padded the string before it. Like, it padded it to set length.
It wasn't it.
Because then once the string is a set length, you can... you can know where the end will be, so you can start at that point and discard. Right. And then you can iteratively remove the start again.
Which meant that if your base string was bigger than whatever the known length was, it just wouldn't work because it couldn't pad it less than it already was.
And I think it capped it at like 1,000 or 100 or something. Like, it was pretty small. Like,
I seem to remember 1,000 or something, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was 1,000.
Oh my god, those were the days. I remember it was before we'd started working together, because we started working on Code of Copper just a bit after 23WO3A, right? But I remember, like, the day after the snapshot released, you posted a link to your Moxlib experimental pack in, I don't know, Datapack Jam or something. Mm. And I remember checking it out and reading through the code and being like, whoa, what is happening here? Because Because it wasn't just that you didn't just have to set an entity's name to be like the storage text component, and then just basically data get that. You had to do like two separate levels of flattening for whatever reason. I don't remember why that was, but yeah, you had to like flatten it once, and then wait a tick, and then flatten it again, and then get the result and store it into a. It was crazy.
I must have like, because we started Coda Copper not long after that release. I must have implemented that super quick. Like, how long did it take me to implement that? Because how many days
was it? Probably a day or something.
Yeah, I think
we started working on Code of Copper like the Sunday, and Snapshot's released on a Wednesday.
So. Yeah, so I must have just spent the like when it came out to like that time, just like quickly, just being like, how do I do this? Quick. I remember at the time, like, reading through the, like, set string, you know, the substring command or whatever it's called. It's hard to call that name, that command.
Yeah.
The string data source? Is that what it's called? I don't know.
Maybe.
But yeah, it was like, I remember looking at it and being like, oh my god, you could do so much to this, but I still can't do proper concatenation.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, we have half of the thing. And macros solved that. But that was still like months, I think. It was like probably 2 or 3 months before we got macros. Would it have been?
Yeah. Maybe
even longer.
Macros were 1.20.2.
Yeah.
And set string was 1.19.4, right?
Yeah.
So it was probably quite a while.
Yeah, it could have been like 3 to 6 months.
Snapshot. When did 1.20 release? Was it summer 2023? Must have been, right?
1.20, yeah, I think so. Like June 2023, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I might have found it. I think I might have found the message you sent.
Oh?
No, hang on, that was the splitting a string. Oh yeah, no, here it is. Well, Moxlib has the ability to concatenate strings 20th of January 2023, and it looks like the snapshot released on the 18th.
Right, so two days after the snapshot. Days,
yeah.
I somehow figured out how to do that. Like, I don't know if I would be capable of figuring that out now. I feel like I'm not in the same data pack mindset I was at that point of time. I mean, I
remember reading through the code and being like, what wizardry is this?
Yeah, Moxlib has a lot of, like, I think Moxlib's an interesting historical data pack. Because like a lot of the stuff isn't so relevant anymore.
A lot of it's obsolete now because you can do it with macros. And so it looks like we decided to start working on Code of Copper on the 22nd, so 2 days after that.
2 days after that. Yeah, I mean the first recent Code of Copper used that function. It didn't actually need to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's another great hack, actually. This is something you should bring up. Code of Copper used this all the time, and I think it still uses it. You can print an array of strings in a tellraw and have them display as if they were, as if they were concatenated. They were, like,
concatenated, yeah.
Yeah.
That's such so useful.
Yeah. And that's interpret true. If you set interpret true on your tellraw JSON, it will interpret the storage or the NBT as JSON rather than printing the NBT stringified. And that there's a lot of times where that's useful. Code of Copper / Golem script uses it a bunch, like for error messages, all kinds of things.
Yeah, for print was the main one initially.
Yeah.
Although now we sort of have that different because we have a string function which does like the same as print instead of printing to the chat, it saves it to a string. And so we just reuse the same function for both. So we basically just have an array of characters. But we still use interpret true actually to concatenate that array. That's true. So yeah. And also on a similar note, if you use, which is also sort of what Moxlib was doing, if you use an entity's name, or now you can do it with a text display, and we also did this for a bit in Code of Copper, you can basically
resolve.
Actually, you don't really need that. No, yeah, no, you do sometimes. Yeah, you can resolve a JSON string basically, or like an array of things into one thing with interpret true on the name, and then basically after, I think it's after one tick, maybe. No, maybe it's straight away actually, because you can set an entity's name from a storage, but then it resolves it immediately to be whatever the storage is. We use that in Code of Copper as well. We use a text display above the golem to display error messages. And we just set that from storage. But you can also use that if you just data get the entity's name after that, then you get the sort of resolved storage. And again, you can do that a lot of the time with macros now, because before you could have used it to turn a value into a string. Tell you what, when they introduced the string storage source, or string data source rather, I had hoped that would allow you to stringify MBT. So if you did like set string storage, and then from like an array,
yeah, it would
stringify it. I had really hoped that it was going to do that, but unfortunately it didn't. But now you can do it with macros. So
yeah.
That's
what I was hoping as well. I was like, oh, hell yeah. Because it would be so much easier to work with. It's like,
yeah,
it's a bit weird to me that it doesn't let you do that, because it just takes a data storage anyway. It's just other types fail, I think. It just only works with strings.
It does. Oh, okay. Here's an interesting idea which I had, which I still kind of want to try, right? So I've seen things that people have made before where they've essentially written an MC function interpreter using macros. So you can essentially write commands in a book and then save it to a storage, and then it executes it, and you can have it run functions and stuff like that, which you define. So it's obviously not as fast as just running MC function directly, because you've got to do a whole macro basically, and it's got to be parsed at runtime rather than at load time. But okay, here's an idea. And I think I might have mentioned it to you before. A data pack, a JIT compiler for MC function. To MC function. So something like Code of Copper or Golem script, we emit MC function and then just run that using macros.
Interesting.
I'm not sure if it would be faster, but it could be fun to make it an MC function JIT compiler. For any of you who don't know, JIT stands for just in time. So some programming languages are just in time compiled, which means instead of compiling them once and then you have a compiled binary and then you can run that binary, when you run it on the source code and it compiles the code in memory and executes it from RAM rather than from disk. A lot of interpreted languages do that. I think Java does that. The JVM JIT compiles it. I think JavaScript does as well.
JavaScript V8 definitely does, yeah.
V8 JIT compiles.
Ruby does as well in some cases. Yeah.
Lua has a JIT compiler. A lot of interpreted languages have JIT compilers because it makes them faster to run.
Yeah.
And I do also want to try, this is just getting on to programming languages again, but I do really want to try making a bytecode interpreter in MC function, because currently we're using a tree walk interpreter for Golem script. And I know in it with other programming languages, tree walk interpreters are generally slower than bytecode interpreters. But that's possibly to do with the fact that, but that might not necessarily be the case in MC function, because here's the thing in MC function, memory is cheaper than compute. So copying a data storage is probably cheaper than running 10 commands to operate on scoreboards. So I don't know. Whereas in a lot of programming languages, compute is cheaper than memory, because a couple CPU instructions is nothing, whereas copying a whole huge data structure in memory can be kind of expensive. So that's possibly to do with why. But I still want to try it. I think it'll be fun. We should do that at some point.
Definitely should. It would be interesting to see, like, if Code of Copper or / Golem script or whatever can be optimized to a point where it's like, you know, Golem script is fairly usable, I'd say, at this point, but it's still not fast. It's not the, like,
no, not you, by any means of the word. Yeah.
You run too much Golem script and your server will start to lag. And it would be really interesting to see how optimized a Minecraft interpreted language could go.
I know. I really want to try making a bytecode interpreter and see what happens.
Yeah, we definitely should. Maybe that will be a project once we've got a release of Zoglin that we can write it. Unless you want to write it by hand, like Code of Copper.
I feel like if we were to, if it was faster, then we would maybe just, then I would say we would just roll that basically in Code of Copper. And we kind of said that we wanted to keep Code of Copper vanilla MC function because it's sort of more impressive that way.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. Yeah. And yeah, I definitely want to make an assembly language, a virtual machine. We should... Tell you what we should do. We should do a podcast episode just designing a virtual machine. I want to design my own computer architecture to run in Minecraft. You know, you have WASM WebAssembly. Yeah. We can make MCASM Minecraft Assembly. MCASM.
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 Nice. MCASM.
We could probably just do a podcast episode just discussing that and how that would work. I think that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah. We could, design it, you know, to the limitations of Minecraft, because we have...
Yeah.
We don't really have bitwise operators, really. We only have...
No.
Basic math, I guess. Mm-hmm. We have basic math.
Yeah, because I remember... Yeah.
We've got cheap memory and expensive commands.
Which is unfortunate for assembly languages, because that's sort of what they're all about, being cheap in commands and expensive in memory, right? That's what makes assembly so fast, because you've got to do a lot of instructions to do something.
Maybe no one's designed a memory fast assembly.
Maybe, yeah.
You know, maybe we should
try it.
Pioneer very niche field of computer science. Minecraft computer science, very important.
Minecraft, best kind of computer science, in my opinion.
This will be taught in schools. That's right.
Yeah, but I remember implementing, because I did implement a machine code a while back in MC function, and I never got around to parsing an assembly language and assembling it into that machine code. But I remember the bitwise operations were, I think I did, yeah, they just weren't very good. They were pretty slow.
Yeah.
Because, you basically have to literally do bitwise operations. Whereas on a CPU, obviously, it can just all be done in parallel on on hardware, right?
Yeah.
Bitwise operations are supported by your physical CPU. But anyway, we can dive into those details when we do that podcast. I think that would be...
Yeah.
I'm excited for that. I think that would be fun.
That would be fun.
Yeah, what other tips and tricks are there for writing MC function?
I guess... Oh, we could talk about the new enchantments. Those are fun.
Yeah. Yeah, we haven't really mentioned those much on the...
No.
On the podcast before, have we?
We haven't talked about it that much. I played around with them a little bit, but I'm not like an expert in them yet, I would say. They're quite interesting. This is the first time where it's easy to get the position of where a player clicks. without having to do any ray casting or anything, you can get the block that they left click. You can't get the block they right click on, which is really annoying, but you can get the block that they left click on. So that's interesting. I guess for people that don't know what we're talking about, Minecraft added a way to make custom enchantments with data packs.
Yeah.
Insanely awesome and complicated system.
It's super complex. I haven't played around with it enough yet.
Yeah. It's so cool. Yeah. I should totally finish the pack. I've got a half finished pack of enchantments, like custom enchantments that I was working on, which would be fun to have, but I haven't finished them. But yeah, the system's really cool. Like, there's a bunch of stuff you can do. Like, it interfaces with the attribute system.
It does a lot of. It feels like over the years, data packs they've been definitely getting sort of less hacky in certain ways. In certain ways.
Yeah.
I mean, now it's just basically macros. So, you know. But yeah, it felt like originally data packs were sort of just, they were just the combination of all the things that commands could do over the years. And you just have to make do with what you had and just sort of figure out how to do stuff. Whereas now there seems like there's proper ways to do things, and enchantments feel like a really well thought out feature, even if they are a little bit confusing in terms of how they're structured. But one thing I really like about enchantments, which unfortunately advancements don't have, is you can change the context in which a function is executed, right? So both advancements and enchantments have the ability to run functions when either the advancement is given or the enchantment thing activates. An advancement, no matter what the criteria is, the context of the function is always as and at the player who just got the advancement. Whereas with enchantments, you can do stuff as separate. Like, you can change the context of a function being run, right?
Yeah. It can now be, as entities around, entity that hit the player, entity that, or at the block where the thing happened, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Which is really cool, yeah. I haven't really played around with enchantments enough yet. I feel like I haven't really had any ideas of stuff to do with enchantments beyond, what people have done already. The only time I've really used enchantments was in the Harlequins data pack, which I use them to detect. I use them to detect right and left. Right click I used an advancement, and left click I used an enchantment for the classic Minecraft sand.
Yeah.
In classic Minecraft, when you left click, you place a block, and then you can right click to toggle between placing and breaking.
Yeah.
So I used right click food detection in combination with left click enchantment detection for that, which worked out well.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Yeah, that was very cool. And left click detection is huge. That is something we've been like has been so painful to do with data packs before. Like you
the
always
only
had to have an entity.
The real way you could do it was with interaction entities, yeah.
Yeah, or the way before that was like invisible entity floating in front of your head.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can like get when the player attacks an entity, but that just sucks.
Yeah, because it blocks your line of sight with other stuff as well.
Yeah. Oh,
which
terrible.
Is, yeah.
Also,
but also,
because
yeah.
entities can't ride players, which is really annoying. They should be able to ride players, in my opinion. I don't know why that restriction is there.
Mm.
But it means that you have to keep teleporting the entity in front of the player, which
yeah.
just is so janky. And like, if the player moves too fast, then because obviously the tick rate is slow, it just doesn't teleport right. And it just doesn't
yeah,
work
yeah,
very
yeah.
well.
It's and so it, annoying.
You can somewhat mitigate it with like player move. The player entered block advancement. Mm. Actually, yeah, this
yeah,
is a
yeah.
great hack as well. Player entered block or entered block or whatever it is, that actually runs more than once a tick. So you can have your function run multiple times sub tick in that advancement only. It's super weird, but it means that you can get slightly more fluid command like motion stuff and with that advancement particularly, rather than it being stuck at once per every 20th of a second.
Yeah, and what was I saying before? Oh yeah, left click. You still can't detect left click detection anywhere. You can only detect it when they hit a block. But one thing I did see that was cool is that since there's no... Because with right click detection, you still have to use ray casting to check a block, basically. And obviously with ray casting, you have to choose how precise your raycast is, and so it's never going to quite be the exact position that the player looked at.
Yeah.
But now with left click detection, with enchantments, you can change the context of where the functions run. You can run it at the position, and you can detect the exact position they clicked.
Mm.
And so one thing I saw is someone made like a little... I don't remember exactly what it was. I think it was a little painting thing which you could paint in individual pixels in a block.
Oh, that's super
which
cool.
was cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, you just reminded me with talking about raycast. Another great hack I came up with is raycasting is another pain as well, because usually with a raycast, it can't do sub-block collisions. So it can stop at a block or an entity, but let's say the block is a stairs, so a chunk of the stairs is there, and normally you would want your raycast to pass through that chunk, because it's not actually, like, the cursor's not actually pointing at the stairs, it's pointing through the stairs, right? And you would expect your raycast to be able to do that, but a traditional raycast cannot. Like, the traditional way of moving forwards and checking if there's a block where it is. Unfortunately, can't do that. However, there is a way to do that raycast that I'm probably not the first one to discover it, but I came up with it a while back. Although I haven't seen it used much. So it might not be very widely known about. But you can use a predicate to see if a player is looking at an entity, and you summon a tiny interaction entity in front of the player, and you, like, using caret notation to perfectly align it in front of where the player is looking, and then you can keep slowly teleporting it backwards until the point that the player is no longer looking at the entity. And at that point,
you've
got the collision, right? And that works through
That's
blocks.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have seen a raycast pack which does check for stuff like that, but it just basically manually hard-coded all the positions. It basically said, if the stairs is this type and the player's curse and the position is in this part of the stair, and it was all sorts of complex stuff, but that's neat, yeah. I think that was probably before interactions existed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another thing you can do with interactions is you can just use them to block the player from doing stuff. Like, we used it in Code of Copper to stop the player from you know, you can detect left and right click and the player won't break the minecart or interact with the minecart. And also, you can use it to do stuff like lock doors, right? If you put an interaction entity around the door, the player can't click on it, and so they can't, and they can't break it either.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
So it's like pseudo adventure mode almost.
Yeah.
Not entirely, because like obviously there's still some things I feel like they can do, but it's pretty effective. They
probably could blow it up with TNT.
Yeah. Well, I guess they can place TNT elsewhere. That's the thing. Adventure mode, you can't place anything either. I feel like as well, client-side mods would be able to bypass it, so it wouldn't be the best restrictions.
Yeah, but yeah, anyway, you can do that. It's not... thing is, nothing in datapacks is perfect, really. Nothing will give you the exact 100% desired result, because it's datapacks, and that's just how they are. But yeah, I feel like most of the hacks we've talked about in this video are sort of obsolete now, because you can just do it with macros mostly. Mm. And yeah, I remember, because I've been making datapacks since 1.16. I started learning them during lockdown, during the pandemic, about 4 years ago. And I remember just, it's changed a lot since then.
Mm.
The whole... like, if I look back on my first data pack, all the different things that it did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. I mean, I was writing commands in, like, 1.10. This is obviously before data packs. And the command syntax is completely different. Entities were, like, capitalized. It had, like, a capitalized name. Like, zombie had a capital Z. And then zombie.
And all the block IDs were numeric IDs, weren't they?
Yep. You had to
Minecraft had a weird block ID system.
You had to use Bedrock test
still
kind of
uses numeric IDs, right?
Yeah, Bedrock still has numeric IDs. Yeah. Yeah, you would use the test for command, which was basically the equivalent of execute if. And you would have to use a comparator on the command block to get any kind of meaningful output. Although they did, at some point they implemented chaining and repeating command blocks. I remember those were fun. I enjoyed those a lot. I got very good at command blocks, actually.
Yeah, I've never really made a command block creation, I don't think. I mean, I've done a bit with them, but I mostly just got into datapacks.
It's funny, because for years and years, like, because obviously I'd done command blocks before datapacks existed. For years, I avoided touching datapacks. I'm like, oh, I don't want to learn this thing. I'm just going to stick to command blocks. And finally, after the, like, 20th world that's running at 1 TPS because of my command block creations, I'm like, okay, maybe it's time to start looking at datapacks. And, yeah, datapacks are a lot nicer. Command blocks are such a pain in the ass.
And distributing your creations are...
you got to distribute a world or a structure block.
Or a one command, which... How did those... because I know they use some sort of command block minecart or something, but I don't understand how that works.
Passengers.
I'm pretty sure that makes sense. It
was just a bunch of command block minecarts as passengers of each other. Then they would summon in command blocks to be permanent into the world.
Yep.
Yeah.
Did you know that's where the command generator MC Stacker got its name?
Yeah. Because it's like for making stacked entities.
Yeah.
MC Stacker is such a good tool. We could talk about some of the tools.
Yeah.
MC Stacker is the, like, I'd say it's probably one of the oldest tools. It's still constantly updated, and it takes a very different approach to a lot of other tools. Well, like, it takes a very different approach to the other main tool, I'd say, like Misod. So MC Stacker is very much built around, like, it doesn't represent the data exactly. It kind of, like, provides abstractions over the data to make it easier to generate commands. I'd say. There's still parts of it that you're like, you're filling out this field and it's exactly going into where the command it would be, right? But it knows certain things, like it knows certain items will have these fields. It's the best for generating a give command. I'll say that. There's no other tool like it for making a give command.
Give command, summon command, I use. Yeah. And yeah, those are the main ones pretty much.
Yeah. Sometimes a set block. Although set block is less common, and you don't usually have to do much data with a set block. Unless you're putting loot tables in or something.
All the stuff where you need to know all the formatted data fields and what they are, what their type is, it's very useful for that.
Mm.
And when you're starting out, then obviously the other one's MISODE, which is generator for all the different kinds of JSON files, advancements, enchantments, dimension files.
Yeah.
Oh my god, I was looking at the preset, like the default overworld dimension file the other day. 200,000 lines.
Uh-huh. It is actually insane. Incomprehensible. I don't know how they came up with that thing. Because obviously I've wanted to make dimensions that are overworld-like, right? Because...
Yeah,
I went through a period of doing a bunch of world gen data packs. I wouldn't say I was the best at it, but I could make somewhat of an atmospheric dimension, I think. I like to think, at least. But, oh god, world gen is such a pain. But yeah, it is hard to make a world generate like the overworld.
Mm-hmm.
And just the amount of, like, biomes, the amount of special conditions that the world generation has.
It's crazy.
It is.
200,000 lines is insane to me.
Yeah.
I wonder what the file size is. Hang on, I'll look up the file size quickly.
I don't think the game actually stores it as JSON, though, I don't think. I think it's actually hard-coded in the code. Because
the world gen files are hard coded, but yeah, 4 megabytes.
4 megabytes.
4 megabytes.
There we go. Is the
overworld dimension.
I mean, then again, that's 4 megabytes JSON. So there's obviously a lot of data in there that's JSON syntax.
Yeah. True, but yeah, the file. If you want to put it in your data pack, that's a pretty big big thing.
If you want to make a small change to the overworld's terrain, there's a 4 megabyte file for you to have fun with. Oh, it is a nightmare to sift through that one. There was actually another tool that I used for world gen. Really great tool. It was called Snowcapped, and it's for generating, like, it's perfect for managing biomes and, like, large-scale world gen.
I'm sure you've shared that link with me before, but I've never... Because I feel like whenever I do world gen, I don't do world gen very often at all, and I still don't really fully understand world gen. Basically... Whenever I do world gen, it's so few and far between that by the time I get round to doing world gen again, I've forgotten everything which I learned or figured out from the last time I did world gen.
Mm.
Probably the biggest world gen project I did was a custom dimension for a data pack jam, which I never ended up finishing. I got the terrain generation working nicely, but I didn't get... But that took me so long to get working, and it was so... exhausting to making world gen files is so tedious.
It's so tedious because so many times you have to actually fully restart the game to check if it works, and then you have something wrong, and the error reporting on world gen is the worst. It doesn't tell you where the error is. It just says there's an error in this file. Figure it out. And usually, like, sometimes the file itself doesn't have an error in, but it's a file linked to that file. And it's like, oh. Actually, I don't remember what it was called. There is a mod that helps with the world gen error reporting. It's so bad. The world gen error reporting is so bad, they made a mod to fix world gen error reporting.
yeah.
I don't remember what it was, We'll try and link to all of these resources in the description or in the show notes when we put this podcast out. And if I manage to remember what that mod was, I'll link it there.
And also I'll say, again, for World Gen, there's one of the members of the Datapack Hub team wrote up a guide on Planet Minecraft about doing World Gen, because he's pretty knowledgeable about that stuff. So we can link that too. I found that helpful. We sort of ended up complaining about World Gen, even though we were supposed to be talking about Datapack tips and tricks. But unless you have any more things, then we can maybe wrap it up here.
Yeah, I'll say one last thing on World Gen. I would say the best workflow, don't do your World Gen in a single player world, do it on a server. It's so much easier to spin up a server and then connect to it than it is to connect it. Like, I don't know what it was, but somehow running World Gen in a server is just a lot faster to debug. Huh. Okay. I think it may be because...
I do really want to learn World Gen at some point, but I just never got around to it.
I think the benefit is that if there's an error, because like the server is immediately logging to the terminal, so it exits very early and you can read it straight away. Whereas if you're doing it in a single player world, you have to tab over to your log. And I'd say that would be the main reason to use a server. So if you ever plan to do World Gen, I would recommend set up a server for yourself. Very easy to do. There's plenty of guides on the internet. And do your World Gen from that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we could probably leave it there.
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, we had a few tips and tricks, even though a lot of them obsolete now. Yeah, we talked about some other stuff. And yeah, I guess we'll see you next time.